It's a pleasure to welcome back Reverend David Moore. We've been the beneficiaries of Reverend Moore's wisdom and insight on a few occasions in the past. I'll leave it to you to check out his impressive resume on our website and on the invitation you received for this session. But for now, I'll just say that he's the husband of Diane, his wife of 38 years, the father of five grown children, holder of a doctorate in theology, an author, the pastor of two churches, and in his spare time, he finds time for social, as a social activist. Like Bishop Curry, he spent time at Standing Rock. Hopefully he'll have something to say about that this morning. So without further ado, I give you Reverend Dr. David Moore, who's going to speak to us on Chapter 10, The Great Relationship Revival. Dr. Moore.
Well, hello, everybody. Good morning. And I have to say that I'm impressed that you have explored the issue of race all of this time, and you know, picking some good reading material. We are in a major, I would say, both countrywide and global shift. And it's an exciting moment in so many ways. I think of how Black, Indigenous, people of color, anybody who has suffered enslavement or colonization, what's happening in the souls of such people. Sometimes I look at it this way, I frame it. When a person has amnesia as the result of trauma, in time they may begin to recover lost memories. And speaking for the people on these shores, we have experienced tremendous historical trauma. And there is a collective remembering happening right now. Things that we repressed, things that we didn't even perhaps sometimes acknowledge as real. We are giving place in our consciousness to the desires and dreams of our ancestors, who have been hoping that we would not forget them. And so now the actions that we take in the interest of justice are all really not just for our children, but they are for our ancestors as well as ourselves. And so there's a different attitude, you might say, emerging, especially in, I would say, younger people of color. There's this remembrance happening, and the attitude emboldens them. And for the first time, I would say, at least in the history of our country, there is a sense of being at home in our own skin. We are very delighted to be who we are, and we don't sense this need to make ourselves small. And we also recognize that sometimes when we are not making ourselves small, it's disorienting to the spirit of white supremacy in our country. So when I look at the book by Michael Curry, Bishop Michael Curry, Love is the Way. There's a powerful message here, but I see so many angles in it, and I'm sure that some of you may have as well. I see so many angles, though, that that probably unless you were a person of those persecuted and underserved peoples, unless you were a true ally of them, they might go overlooked. They are especially, I would say, especially clear to me because of my background. I've had the privilege for almost 30 years now. I've been ordained in ministry for almost 40 years, but I've been a part of two denominations for almost 30 years. And what is distinct about this is that one of the denominations is historically Black church. And then a decade after that, I was invited to lead another congregation in a historically predominantly white denomination. And so I have been looking at the similarities and the differences. On paper, in official statements of faith and doctrine and such, they're nearly identical, but in practice and performance, they are, you would barely recognize that they are family. And so I have a feel for the mentality of Bishop Michael Curry, who is, as some of you may know, is a pretty spectacular individual. The Brits were not extremely fond of the way that he officiated the marriage ceremony of how he spoke at the wedding of Harry and Meghan. Which is to be understood. First of all, he's not British, and so that right there would almost completely disqualify him. But when he brought the character and the shape of Black preaching into that in that moment, it was disruptive. I would dare say that it's not nearly as disruptive as a person who did not have Michael Curry's bona fides in terms of functioning in a historically white tradition. And certainly he has learned some things that that are helping him to operate. But I say all of that as a backdrop to show how my experience at Standing Rock, I was refreshed to read it written by, Bishop Michael Curry. But the way I would and the way I have reported that experience is very different from the way it's reported in his book. The events are essentially the same, but the way they came across, the way that I have told that portion of the story is somewhat different. And so I'll start with this. First of all, on page 212, he says, "At first I saw my trip," and I can certainly appreciate this. He said, "I saw my trip to Standing Rock primarily as being about racial justice." When he left and later had a conversation with Stephanie Spellers, his canon who leads their environmental stewardship she attended, and so he gets some of his information from her. In fact, he says these words: "She is the source of the description of those days that you're about to read." And let me just mention that not just Michael Curry, but Stephanie Sellers is also African American. And she wrote, "On the first night clergy arrived, the Sioux elders called them together in a gymnasium." And I won't go into read all of that, but I'll move on. "The next morning started with a ritual. Standing in the cold November air, elders from each of the major faith traditions, present repudiated the ancient doctrine of discovery and then burned a copy of it. Then they read an apology to Native Americans and to the earth." And so I want to talk about that. But as I do, I want to say it first, that I really would love for this to be a conversation rather than a lecture. I would love to bring, because, you know, we learn from one another. And if I do have any answers, I might not be answering the questions that are on your mind. So that's why we'll chop it up in a few. She's after reading the Doctrine of Discovery, she says, "Though they did not use this language, they apologized for treating creation and the Native people as an it rather than a thou, for seeing Native Americans as obstacles and objects instead of fellow creatures of God's great earth, deserving of autonomy and respect." Well, I found this whole event so inspiring and energizing that I later that day, I got in touch with Mark Charles. And I don't know if you know who Mark Charles is, but he is a Native American who lives in Washington, D.C., and he works as an advocate. And just for the record, he co-wrote a book with Sung Chun Ra. And the name of the book is, well, we'll get to the book later. But anyway, he wrote a book that Sung Chun Ra is a Korean American theologian, pastor, author. He used to teach at North Park Seminary, and now he's at Fuller. But he has written a lot about lament, about the need for the Imperial Church to lament, experience an empathy that brings about a brokenness. So yeah, Tim's put it in there. Thanks, Tim. I got in touch with Mark Charles, who is the co-author of that book, later that day in Washington. And I told him, I said, basically what I just read here, I said that these major faith traditions repudiated the copy of the ancient doctrine of discovery and, you know, had it on paper and threw it into the fire. And there was a moment of, I mean, it was emotional. You could feel it. At least I could. You know, I don't know exactly how the multiple nations that were represented, their indigenous nations, there were indigenous nations that hadn't been on the same page for quite some time, who had come together over the cause of water, because water is life. And that was urgent enough that it lowered the barrier so that they could come together. But not only were there, and I have to say that one of the things that impacted me early on was going into the camp and seeing maybe 70, maybe 80 flags on tall flagpoles representing multiple nations, people from all over North America, but there were also indigenous people from around the world who had traveled to Standing Rock. When I talked to Mark Charles, his first reply was, was there any representation from the Roman Catholic Church? And I said, no, not as far as the ceremony was concerned, no. And so Mark Charles says, well, then it really doesn't mean that very much. It doesn't mean very much. You know, as a Native American, for him, it has to go to the root of where it started. And so there I was, you know, like a little kid in a way, even though I'm older than Mark Charles, I was like a little kid running home to tell my parents something great that happened. And my parents just, you know, just deflated me. But it was sobering. And I appreciate his candor and vulnerability, transparency, and my ability to be open to it. And so that's what we talked about. And but the way that I've told that story is just a little different. Because as I've told people about the burning of the document, I said, I didn't use the words major faith traditions or elders from the major faith traditions. I said the elders from the major white faith traditions, because there were no people of color. And I'm not saying there should have been, but it just in the interest of accuracy, of clarity, there were no people of color represented, no traditions of color represented there. And again, I'm not saying there should have been. The following afternoon, that same day, the following afternoon, thousands of us gathered. There was a makeshift platform for speakers and a microphone out close to the river. And I would find out later from some of the natives, because I was amazed at how safe we were, because there were so many reports of violence. And I mean, there was an element of intimidation, because 24/7, I mean, people, you know, couldn't even sleep very well, because 24/7, there were jets and helicopters going over the camp. And of course, there were armed imperialists on the other side of the river. And but we never, while we were there, we never faced any overt threats. And I was curious about that. And the natives there, they were saying that whenever there's a large number of white people who come, they back down. They just stand down. They're not as visible. But what I wanted to get to is that afternoon, after the ceremony that I just read about, that afternoon on the stage were a number of speakers, but the speakers were not white. The speakers were first and foremost, they were indigenous people, elders. LaDonna Braveheart, who recently passed away, was a highly respected elder among all the Sioux people, the Sioux nations. And there were other speakers who were African American. There was a delegation from the African Methodist Episcopal Church. Some of the speakers were from other places, other countries like Samoa, American Samoa. You know, I remember the speaker from Samoa saying that they called us savages. But look at what they're doing here, and we're the savages. nonviolently resisting in this case. It's where I met a friend who I now speak to almost weekly. Her name is Sahar Aslahani. She's an Iraqi-American Muslim. And I was so taken by her speech that I waited through the crowd when it was over to try to see if I could find her and not appear like I was trying to, you know, get her digits, if you will. But I really wanted to be further in touch with her. And so I, you know, we exchanged phone numbers. And I just said to her, you know, I would love to be able to host you in Santa Barbara sometime. And anyway, that, without any idea of that being a possibility, you know, realistic possibility. And then about maybe 2 years later, maybe less than 2 years later, I got a message from Sahar, actually a phone call. And she says, I'm going to be in Santa Barbara this weekend. And to give you an idea of what kind of Muslim she is. She says, I'm coming to officiate a wedding, which, you know, being a woman was a little bit surprising. And she said, yes, I have a couple of gay friends who are getting married. And, I thought, all right, Sahar. So anyway, she did come into town and she spoke at our church, and we have been regularly in touch since then. But she was fresh from Charlottesville. She was there on the front lines of clergy. Even though she's not technically like clergy herself, but she was on the front lines. And she was there when the way she relates it is so, it's kind of chilling, but when the neo-Nazis and all of those that were marching with their torches, they were walking towards this line of clergy, and they were saying, Jews will not replace us. Jews will not replace us. And when they saw the diversity of the clergy there, in different vestments and such, they switched it from Jews will not replace us to you will not replace us. And this is something that I would say that Sahar embodies, this spirit of resistance to inequity and abuse in the world. And she brings something of her Iraqi experience, even though she did not live, she was born there, but she didn't live there during the wars that happened, but her family is there. And so she has this perspective about violence and oppression. I mean, she just really has, you know, really sound chops when it comes to that. But what I experienced that afternoon, when not just Sahar, but so many others were making their presentations, was an awareness that everybody talking today, all of the individual presenters are people of color. They are Black, Indigenous, and people of color. And it became clearer to me that these are the people that are part of the apology, the recipients of the apology. Even though they were not all Standing Rock Sioux, they are the people who, like myself, really felt that apology very deeply. So, when all of this went down, it became a life-changing experience, and I shared it with, you know, I've shared it with so many people over and over again, and I have relationships not with just Sahar, but with other people that are you know, powerful relationships, and some of them I already had, but our relationships got deeper. And when I say already had, I'm talking about people who were local. The Reverend Karen Sheldon, who used to be at Trinity Episcopal here in Santa Barbara, she was there. And the Reverend Julia Hamilton at the the UU Church, Unitarian Universalist Church here in Santa Barbara, she was there. And it was like all of the people that were there were brought into a communion. Another level of being the communion of the saints that has not been broken. And so those are the things that I have emphasized from my experience. But there's another observation, and then we'll open the floor, that I can detect from Michael Curry. You see, in our society, a Black person in white spaces has to be especially skilled at negotiating people's emotions. And Michael Curry does that with his book because it is written, you know, even though the two protagonists, if you will, of this chapter are both African American, he has written it in a way that would be more palatable to his own constituency. There's no way you rise to the highest office to the bishopric of the of a historically and traditionally white and Anglican institution without knowing some things, without being able to be sensitive in a way that maybe others would not have to be sensitive. And I would say that for myself, who shares that experience as a pastor for many years of a predominantly white congregation, these are the things that are different between Bishop Michael Curry and myself. He's in an elected role, and he can't take the risks that I take, if you will, because he's leading people all over the country, and it's his responsibility to bring about some kind of coalescence to preserve some kind of unity or create some kind of unity, as the case is now with the Episcopal Church in America. Whereas my role has been different from that because I have stopped trying to be I was putting too much pressure on myself to fit into my own congregation, if you will. Those are days long past. But I began to recognize that white people are generally more comfortable in white spaces. It's like home for them in many ways. And to come to a space that is led by an African American, There's a desire for many people to escape the imperial Western Christian mode of practice, but it's such a shock in some ways if they've not had that kind of experience, if they've not lived in allyship for some period of time, or if they probably the biggest way of access to our world as African Americans is to actually be married to a person who's African American and also conscious, of course. And that changes everything. Well, Bishop Michael Curry, I wouldn't say that he's not married to the Episcopal Church, of course, but I've come to a place where, I am being my full self. I essentially give myself away in ways that I think, as far as I know, would be no different if I were in an entirely Black setting, which I was surprised to find out was refreshing for some people who have known me all along, because they were waiting for that, David. They were waiting to connect more deeply. But for other people, they came and went. There was too much emphasis on race, too much talk about white supremacy and imperialism and and that kind of thing. Even though that's not the only thing that I preach about, I do preach about it, but when you don't get it in the church you've been to or in the environment you've been a part of, it seems like I'm preaching about that every week. And so I think I'll pause here, and I hope that some wheels are turning so that we can all learn together.